Good morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Andrew Valls, professor of political science at Morehouse College, and our topic is racism. Andrew, glad to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
This past year, the United Nations sponsored a world conference on racism that was held in South Africa. I wonder if you could briefly explain what you think promoted the idea of the UN holding this conference and what they hope to achieve by having it.
Well, the UN has always been deeply concerned about issues of racism. There are many UN documents that give reference to racism and the problem of racial discrimination. And the UN has also held conferences in the past with regard to issues of racism in 1978 and in 1983. In addition, we're coming to the end of the third decade for action to combat racism that the UN had declared, which ends in 2002. So I think that the UN wanted to sort of take stock of where the world is with regard to issues of racism. And they more specifically, I think, wanted to hold the conference in South Africa in order to sort of celebrate South Africa's triumph over apartheid.
Okay, the fact that there have been other conferences before would seem to indicate that the first conferences didn't achieve what they had hoped to achieve. Is that correct?
To a certain extent. The previous conferences were much more narrowly focused. The one in 1978 was focused on decolonization, and the one in 1983 was focused on the apartheid system in South Africa. The aim, I think, with this more recent conference was to have a much broader agenda and also to have a much more sort of action-oriented conference. It was more action-oriented in that the hope was that coming out of the conference would be a program of action that states and international organizations could actually undertake in order to combat racism. And I think that the broader agenda is also suggested by the official title of the conference, which was the World Conference Against Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance. So I think that they were attempting to have a much broader discussion about different kinds of intolerance, different kinds of racism, with an eye towards what states and international organizations can actually do to combat these more effectively.
Well, you've mentioned a couple times that the aim was broader. I mean, what were some of the aims of this conference?
Well, I think that there were a number. One thing that we should note sort of on the side is that the conference was not just a meeting of governments, but it was also a forum for non-governmental organizations, victims groups, and so on to meet and sort of share their experiences, share their insights. And in fact, in terms of the number of people that attended, there were more people participating in the NGO conference than in the official conference. But in the official conference, as well as the NGO shadow conference, I believe that there was an attempt to highlight the various different kinds of racism and kinds of intolerance that are experienced around the world. I think that the conference was premised on the notion that indeed all societies have problems with racism and with intolerance, and that something could be gained from sharing the various insights and experiences from different groups.
Could you mention some specific forms of racism or types of racism that were mentioned?
Sure, yeah. There are different kinds of groups throughout the world that experience different kinds of racism. For example, perhaps the best known to an American audience is, of course, African Americans in the United States. But also other parts of the world have very distinct kinds of racism associated with particular kinds of groups. There's untouchability and the caste system in South Asia. There's the Roma, better known as gypsies, in Western Europe. There are migrants and refugees and asylum seekers that face their own distinctive kinds of problems. There's the rights of indigenous peoples in various parts of the world. There's the victims of colonialism in many parts of the world as well. And each of these kinds of groups face their own distinctive problems and issues, although much can be learned, I think, from sort of comparing notes, so to speak, among the different groups, and I think that was part of the point here.
Did the conference succeed in...
Did the conference succeed? That is a good question and a very controversial one. From the point of view of many observers, the conference was a failure and was doomed to be a failure from the start. Much of the media attention on the conference focused on some disputes that made it appear that not much was being done that was very productive at the conference. And indeed, it often looked as if the conference was poorly planned, because many times with these UN conferences, really the substantive issues are sort of decided ahead of time, and then the conference is just sort of an opportunity to discuss what has already been decided upon. Whereas here, there were clearly important issues that had not been decided, and because some of the disputes involving these seemed to be so bitter, that many observers thought that the conference was just a failure. But it should be also noted that many of the participants, despite this, thought that it was quite a success and that there was some value in simply raising these issues and in sharing experiences.
All right, you mentioned that there were a number of issues, including very contentious issues that were discussed. Perhaps you could identify a few of those that you think are most important and ones we can focus on in the remainder of the interview.
Sure. One that received an inordinate amount of media attention, which we may or may not want to discuss any further, is the dispute over how to characterize the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories. This was actually the issue that led to the U.S. withdrawing from the conference, as well as the Israeli delegation withdrawing from it. This, unfortunately, was something of a distraction, I think, in the conference. And though I do think that it received more media attention than it deserved, it also, to the actual participants in the conference, did serve to be something of a side issue. But perhaps a bigger issue that was more central to the conference was the issue of how to respond to the legacy of slavery and the slave trade, and in particular whether Western powers should apologize for and perhaps pay compensation for victims of slavery and the slave trade.
Okay, so the main one you would say would be slavery and the slave trade. Was colonization mentioned, or was that somehow treated as if it were the same problem as the issue of slavery and slave trade?
Yeah, of course the two things are closely related, particularly in the case of Africa, but they are distinct, because the issue of European colonization of Africa certainly raises its own kinds of issues, particularly since, of course, that colonization ended much more recently than slavery and the slave trade did. So certainly the European colonization of Africa was a prominent theme, and it was indeed one of the central issues that was sort of a matter of dispute. A lot of the discussion during the conference, in fact, was on the wording of the declarations and whether, for example, colonization should be something that Europeans should acknowledge as having been an injustice, and what sorts of measures it should take out of that.
And so to that extent, there's a common thread between the issue of colonization and slavery, namely, should there be an open acknowledgement, apology for it, and on top of that, should there be some kind of reparations?
That's right, yes.
Okay. How would you basically divide? I mean, it sounds as if there was a pretty important divide in the meeting between the people who thought apologies and or reparations were inappropriate and those who thought they were obligatory. Mm-hmm. Basically, who was on each side of this debate? And perhaps summarize some of the central concerns and arguments on each side.
Sure. Yes. Well, primarily the groups that were pushing for reparations of various sorts, whether for colonization, for slavery and the slave trade, and whether we're talking about international reparations from Europe or the United States to, say, Africa, or domestic reparations, say, within the United States from the U.S. government to African Americans. On all of those issues, there was sort of a constellation of forces, pro and con. Talking about Africa first, many African leaders were strongly pushing for an apology for slavery, for colonization, pushing for the acknowledgement of some kind of reparations that ought to be paid because of this. Although it should be noted that not all African leaders were in favor of this. But generally speaking, the European nations were against this. There seemed to be a sentiment on the part of the European nations that some kind of acknowledgement should be made, but that the acknowledgement should stop short of an apology, and also the characterization should stop short of calling these events crimes against humanity. And the main motivation here was that the fear of that such an apology or such a characterization would leave European nations open to being sued in some kind of an international court and would leave them liable to having to pay reparations.
Okay, so mainly the countries that were colonizers and or slave traders were opposed to it, and those who had been victims of colonization and slave trade were in favor of it.
Yeah, roughly.
Yeah. Were all European countries, did all of them have misgivings about acknowledging and apologizing? I mean, I wonder, for example, about European countries that didn't play such a large role in colonization, if they were aligning with the other European countries or with the African countries on this issue?
Yes, generally speaking, they align themselves with other European countries, even if they themselves had no reason to think that they would be liable to pay reparations. Although some European nations took a sort of a mediating role in these regards. For example, Norway, I believe, on some of these more contentious issues, took a leading role in trying to mediate some of these disputes. But generally speaking, European nations as a whole were very concerned about the implications of an out-and-out apology.
Okay. I think maybe it's helpful to divide this into two issues, and they're both clearly related as you've talked about them. One is the question of whether there should be an apology of some sort, and the second is whether there should be reparations of some sort. And as you described it, the fear on the part of some of the European countries was that if you do the first, then you're committed to the second. Let's see, though, if we could separate them for a moment. I mean, what did anyone raise any arguments for saying why we shouldn't apologize other than the fear of these implications?
Generally speaking, and both sort of in the scholarly debate about these issues and at the conference, yes, there are some arguments that are raised about why an apology should not be made. Some people have argued, for example, that an apology simply doesn't make any sense, that those people who are living today are not the individuals who engaged in the acts for which they would be apologizing, and that therefore it simply doesn't make any sense. It's sort of a way of perhaps placating people, but that ultimately it simply won't make any difference. And so some people have argued along those lines that an apology doesn't make any sense. Other people have argued that an apology is sort of a cheap way out, that it doesn't make any difference. And some victims groups have actually argued along these lines that simply apologizing without anything in addition to it is sort of an empty gesture. And so there have actually been arguments on both sides about the limits of apologies and whether they make any difference at all.
Okay, I want to explore both of those themes in the second half of the show. I'd like to pause just a moment. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Andrew Valls, professor of political science at Morehouse College, and we're talking about racism. The issue of apologies, and the arguments, it seems to me, are very different as you describe them. One is an argument that because the people who were the perpetrators of these evils are no longer the people in power, why should their predecessors apologize for what they did? The second was a fear that maybe the apology, if it wasn't accompanied by reparation, would just be an empty gesture. On the first one, though, I certainly have heard comments from people in the United States which indicates a certain continuing distrust or disdain for the Germans and or the Japanese. Mm-hmm. that maybe they don't feel appropriately apologetic for what they did. Is the issue of apology here fairly similar in your view?
Absolutely. And in fact, if you look at recent history, certainly since the Second World War, there have been a number of apologies or proposed apologies that have raised all kinds of interesting issues. The German apologies for the Holocaust and the reparations that they have paid to Jewish groups and to the State of Israel, the apologies of the Japanese to a number of different groups and nations in Asia, for example, to the Asian so-called comfort women who were essentially held in sexual slavery during World War II. There have been many instances where the issue of apologies have been raised. Very often in more recent times, in the last couple of decades, where there has been a transition to democracy, whether in Eastern Europe or in Latin America, the question of whether the new regime should apologize for the sins, so to speak, of the old regime has been raised.
Let's move to the second part of that issue, the issue of reparations. What are the main arguments for saying that some kind of reparations are due to victims of, and we're talking about here not just casual or minor discrimination, we're talking about substantial, ongoing discrimination. What are the main kind of arguments that are being given for reparations?
Well, I think that the main argument is that the previous historical racial injustices that were perpetrated upon people continue to have an effect in the present. That is, if you look at present-day society, whether we're talking about the U.S. or another society, often you can see the effects of past racial injustices in the present-day society, and that therefore, as long as compensation or reparations are not paid to those groups who continue to suffer because of the historical injustices, then that constitutes a kind of an ongoing injustice. If you look, for example, at the U.S. case, on almost any measure of well-being in the United States, whether it's level of education, income, wealth, health, there continues to be a large gap between whites and blacks in the U.S. And some have argued that most of that gap continues to be attributable to the racist practices that are a part of our history, and that to fail to try to remedy and to close that gap constitutes, as I said, a kind of an ongoing injustice that is intolerable.
Okay, so it's pretty clear that a key element of the argument is not just, let me see if I can put it this way, that in some sense talk about an injustice in the distant past is a bit misleading, mm-hmm. because the injustices didn't happen a long time ago and then stop. They have ongoing effects.
Right.
Actually, maybe it would be helpful to spell out what you take those effects to be. I mean, when you say that they're ongoing effects of slavery or of colonization, I mean, can you be more specific about what kind of effects you have in mind?
Well, when we're talking about slavery, the present-day effects of slavery in the U.S., there are all kinds of effects, I believe. If you look at the residential segregation that African Americans continue to experience, the kind of social isolation that results from that, the differences in achievement in education, and as I mentioned, in wealth and income. All of those, I think, are part of a kind of a continuation of the official policies, certainly in parts of the U.S., before the civil rights movement. And though the U.S. has sort of tried to make some amends and certainly has shifted to a policy where de jure, that is legally enforced segregation, is no longer policy. Some have argued that the U.S. has inadequately addressed the effects of those past policies, so that we essentially have seen them perpetuated into the present and presumably into the future, because once put in place, those sorts of patterns are very difficult to change unless they are attacked directly.
Okay. I mean, to some degree, maybe you've in part answered this question earlier when we were talking about apologies, but what are the main arguments against reparations?
Well, there are a number, and they are very serious ones. I already did mention the notion that, you know, if you look at things in terms of the individuals who are involved, often the individuals who suffered particular injustices in the past, as well as those that perpetrated them, are no longer around. And so some argue that that undercuts the case for reparations. Others argue, though, that the focus on the past that the issue of reparations involves has many negative consequences, that it keeps people focused on their victimhood, or it keeps them from looking forward in terms of what can be different in the future, and rather keeps them focused on the wrongs of the past. And some people make what is essentially an empirical argument to say that the current disparities in wealth and income and other measures of well-being are not entirely, or not even mainly, due to the injustices of the past, and that the best way to ensure social equality isn't through some kind of a reparation scheme, but rather through simply trying to ensure equality of opportunity from now on. And so I think that there are a number of very serious issues that are raised by opponents to reparations.
Okay, and so one way of saying it is that earlier in explaining one of the major arguments for reparations, you said the fact that historical injustice isn't just historical, it has ongoing consequences, itself is a crucial claim that at least some of the opponents of reparation will make. In fact, maybe all of them would make it. But secondly, you also then talked about the potential negative effects of looking at the past, even if it were true.
Yes.
That there were these injustices. What would you say to both of those? What kind of response might you give to both of those objections to the idea of reparations?
Well, I think on the first one, I think actually this is one of the weaker arguments that opponents to reparations make, because I think it's very difficult to argue, at least in the case of the U.S., that the present disparities that exist between whites and blacks in the U.S. Have nothing to do with the history of discrimination in this country. I think that that's a pretty tough argument to make, because if you look at our recent history, there's never been a time, really, when there was real equality of opportunity. There's never been a time when the slate has, so to speak, been wiped clean and we've been able to start over. And so that's a pretty tough argument to sustain, I think, for the opponents of reparations. But on the issue of the value of looking back versus looking forward, that's a more complicated issue, I believe, because I think that it makes sense to think that focusing on the past somehow distracts from what we could or should be doing now and in the future. But I think that if experience has taught us anything, and here, again, I think it's helpful to look at the experience in other countries, often looking to the past is a necessary prerequisite to moving on as a society. Again, if you look at the transitions to democracy that have taken place around the world in the last couple of decades, usually there is some kind of an attempt to reckon with the past, to acknowledge the injustices of the past as a means towards moving forward. And so I don't think that it's an either-or kind of issue where the choice is that we either look to the past or we focus on the future. I think that one is kind of a necessary means to the other, actually.
Now, most of the examples you've been giving look as if the primary solution is going to have to be internal to the country.
Mm-hmm.
If that's true, what's the advantage of addressing this problem on an international level?
On an international level?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of points, to be made about that. First is that even where reparations and apologies and these issues about the effects of slavery and the effects of all kinds of racial intolerance, even where those are being handled domestically, there's something to be learned from different national experiences. Perhaps the U.S. can learn something about the process that South Africa has gone through. And certainly South Africa learned from previous experiences as well. So I think one of the values of this conference and one of the values of looking at this internationally is that there's a lot of experience, a wealth of experience that can be drawn upon as each country attempts to look at its particular problems. But I also think that the issue of international reparations is an important one, and it's certainly one that received a lot of attention at the conference. The whole question of whether or not European powers should pay reparations, say, to Africa for colonization, whether the U.S. should pay reparations to Africa for the slave trade and for slavery. There are clearly some issues of international reparations that were addressed. Some suggested, for example, that the current system that we have in the international arena should be characterized as a kind of global apartheid that has grown out of past injustices. And so there is definitely an international dimension to all of this as well.
In the last couple of minutes of the show, I wonder if you could speculate on where you think this discussion might go, whether there'll be other conferences, whether there will be fruits of the past conference that might in fact help countries like the United States think about its actions in the past. Where do you see all this discussion going?
One of the things that came out of the conference was a couple of documents, a program of action and a declaration that the participating countries signed on to. And so this becomes something of a benchmark against which the actions of individual countries can be measured. And so that's one thing that has come out of this conference. And hopefully these documents will continue to sort of inform debates about issues of race around the world as well as in the U.S. Another thing that came out of the conference is that a lot of networking took place, particularly in the NGO component of the conference. And so
NGOs are for those
non-governmental organizations, right? And this was the sort of shadow conference that occurred along with the official state UN conference. And a lot of networking, a lot of exchanging of information occurred there. And so perhaps some forms of cooperation will come out of that. And as far as the U.S. goes, I do think that this is an issue that's going to continue to be discussed, and that some things that came out of the conference may be helpful. For example, members of the Congressional Black Caucus attended the conference and were one of the forces that were pushing the idea of black reparations within the U.S. And this is going to continue, I think, to be a topic of conversation in this country. I think that the conference only sort of strengthened the position of those who are advocating these kinds of reparations.
Well, thank you very much for appearing in the show today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking today with Andrew Valls, professor of political science at Morehouse College. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.